Okay, so I want you to take a second and just, imagine how scientific theories are usually built.
Right, yeah, it's a whole thing.
It really is. Like, if you've ever spent any time around academia, or honestly, even if you've just tried to read a really dense nonfiction book, you know the drill.
Oh, absolutely.
It is this slow, almost glacial grinding process. You have peer review, you have these massive, exhaustive literature reviews, and then you have those endless, sprawling lists of citations at the back of the paper.
Yeah, the bibliography that goes on for pages.
Exactly. It is an entire global ecosystem, right?
Yeah.
And it's built entirely on tracing the lineage of an idea. The
Right.
rule is you have to prove exactly who thought of what and when they thought of it, and precisely how your one tiny specific addition fits onto the top of this massive towering mountain of existing literature.
It's archaeology in a way.
Archaeology, yeah, that's a good word for it.
You're constantly digging through the strata of past publications just to justify your right to plant a flag on the surface. And the underlying assumption is that you cannot be taken seriously unless you map out exactly whose shoulders you were standing on.
Right. It's an entire economy of borrowed authority. But what if someone came along and looked at that entire system, the citations, the peer review, the academic signaling, and just said, no, thank you?
It's a wild thought.
Right. What if a researcher decided to completely bypass that entire system and build something totally different?
It's a deeply provocative thought, and well, it's exactly what is happening right now. We are watching it happen in real time with the Rizart Research Archive.
Yeah, where?
They are currently executing a massive structural transition. And when I
Yeah.
say massive, I mean they are fundamentally tearing down the walls of how a research archive is supposed to function and completely repositioning themselves.
And that is our mission for this deep dive. Okay, let's unpack this because we are looking at a total architectural shift in how human knowledge, specifically regarding the human mind, is being produced and validated. The
Exactly.
Brizart Research Archive is intentionally moving away from being a traditional, literature layer of academia. Instead, they are transforming into an institutional-grade framework production system.
Which, and this is key, completely redefines the end product. The end product is no longer a paper that you read. The end product is a system that you run.
Run like software.
Yeah.
So we're going to pull this all apart today because the strategy here is honestly fascinating. We are going to explore their intentional outsider positioning. We're going to look at their raw-to-polish pipeline, which is how a messy human thought turns into hard math.
It's quite a pipeline, yeah.
Oh, it really is. We are going to dive into the fact that they are strategically releasing executable Python code instead of just philosophical essays. And maybe most importantly, we're going to look at the data to see why institutional research labs are suddenly willing to bypass all those traditional peer review credibility signals just to download and test these frameworks themselves.
It really is a rebellion against the standard operating procedure of cognitive science, but it's a very calculated rebellion.
Very calculated.
To understand the scale of it, we need to look at the archive's recent public updates. They posted a notice titled Massive Structural Changes Ahead.
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, and they are restructuring their entire public-facing site to match the rigorous architecture of their Zenodo releases. They are stripping out the noise, removing the casual commentary, and building a clean, authoritative interface for the labs and institutional partners who rely on their frameworks.
So they want to be seen as a stable institutional-grade archive.
Yeah.
But the way they're going about establishing that authority is, well, it's breaking every rule in the academic playbook.
That is an understatement.
Right. And nowhere is that more obvious than in their FAQ section. There was one specific question in there that caught me completely off guard. The question is simply, why don't you use references anymore?
It's the ultimate academic taboo.
Is it ever?
Publishing complex theoretical frameworks without a bibliography is, I mean, it's like showing up to court without a lawyer. It just isn't done.
It's unheard of.
Yeah.
If I handed you a 40-page paper proposing a unified theory of human memory and perception, and the bibliography was just empty, you'd think I was a crank.
I absolutely would.
But their response to this question is incredibly bold. They explicitly state that their approach is intentionally different from standard academic practice. They say, and I'm quoting here, Brizart Research Archive is not a literature review layer, it's a framework production system.
Right.
Their priority isn't to trace where an idea came from. Their priority is to construct systems that stand on their own. They are building frameworks that are complete, internally consistent, and immediately usable without needing any external context.
The mechanics of this shift are really what's interesting. If we connect this to the bigger picture, we need to look at what standard academic practice actually does.
Okay, yeah.
In traditional science, citations aren't just about giving credit. They are used as a mechanical proxy for credibility. If you submit a paper and you have 100 citations from prestigious journals, your paper is considered credible by reviewers before anyone has even tested your hypothesis in a lab.
Right, because you're leaning on the reputation of the people you cited.
Exactly. You borrow authority from the network of people you cite.
Yep.
BreezeArt is actively, aggressively discarding that proxy. They are insisting that every single release must function entirely on its own internal consistency. It is a self-contained engine, not a node in a citation network.
I understand the philosophy of this idea of a self-contained engine, but I'm hung up on the reality of this. Isn't stripping away references incredibly dangerous?
Well, it depends on how you look at it.
I mean, if you don't cite your sources, how does anyone know you aren't just making it all up in a total vacuum? To use an analogy, if you're building software, publishing an academic paper is like publishing a heavily annotated design document. You have footnotes explaining why you chose this database over that database, citing other engineers. BreezeArt is basically just throwing a compiled, executable software application over the wall and saying, here.
That is actually a very illuminating analogy. And if we follow that analogy through, how do you evaluate a compiled software application?
You don't read its bibliography.
Exactly.
You just run the app. You open the program. You hit execute. And if it crashes on the home screen, it's bad code. If it runs perfectly and does what it's supposed to do, it's good code. The historical lineage of the code doesn't matter nearly as much as the actual mechanical function of the code in real time.
Precisely, and that is exactly the paradigm shift BreezeArt is forcing onto the field. The FAQ clearly states, evaluation is expected to happen after release.
After release, wow.
Yes. This forces an entirely new behavior from research labs. In the old model, the evaluation happens before publication, right? By peer reviewers who judge the bibliography and the methodology.
Yeah.
In this new model, labs interact with the framework directly. They evaluate it after release through direct implementation, modification, and testing. You don't trust the framework because it cited a famous neuroscientist. You trust it because you ran the mathematical framework in your own lab with your own data and the internal logic held up.
It flips the burden of proof entirely.
Yeah.
But here's my issue. Even if we accept the software analogy, software still has version histories. It has developer logs.
It does, yes.
If you aren't using references to show where your ideas come from, how do you prove your frameworks didn't just magically appear out of thin air? You still have to show the work, don't you? If I'm a researcher downloading this, I need to know the origin story of the logic.
You do. You absolutely have to show the work. Otherwise, it is indistinguishable from dogma. And this brings us to another fascinating FAQ regarding what the archive calls research fragments. They recognize this exact problem. So the archive includes selected pre-framework materials, specifically things like PRETFL notes. The explicit goal here is to give controlled visibility into the early stages of development.
I see.
It documents mechanically how these massive formal structures actually emerge from recurring observations rather than from reading other people's paper.
Ah, so this is the Rada-Polish pipeline. And honestly, digging through this raw material is where things get really tangible. We actually get to look at the messy, unpolished human thought process before it gets locked into a formalized system.
It's rare to see that level of transparency.
It really is.
Yeah.
There's a document in the archive titled Early Structure Attempt.docs. And it is exactly what it sounds like. The researchers just typing out raw, fragmented thoughts. They write, maybe there are components here, not just one thing looping, more like different pieces interacting. Current input, memory, expectation, emotional influence.
Very stream of consciousness.
Completely. And then they literally type out, but I don't know how they connect yet.
It's the cognitive equivalent of trying to organize a massive, chaotic, physical space. You know all the objects are in the room, but you don't know the architecture of the room yet.
Exactly. They are asking these really foundational questions on the page. Things like, do they happen one after another? Or all at once? What drives what yet? Like, does memory come in first? Or does expectation shape what memory shows up? It's a very vulnerable document.
It is.
This is what actual scientific discovery looks like behind closed doors before it gets sanitized and dressed up in jargon for a journal submission.
And if we look at another fragment, the readingfragments.docs, we can actually see the ghost of a bibliography, but it's being used in a completely different way than standard academia.
How so?
We see the scattered early synthesis of external concepts. The researcher isn't citing these concepts to borrow authority. They are wrestling with them as raw materials. They specifically reference Andy Clark's work on predictive brains, Daniel Schachter's work on constructive memory, and Anil Seth's work on interoceptive inference.
Okay, let's pause and actually break those down because we need to understand what the researcher is wrestling with here. Let's start with Andy Clark and predictive brains. What does that actually mean in a mechanical sense?
Sure. So the traditional view of the brain is that it is a passive receiver. You open your eyes, light hits your retina, the signal goes to the back of your brain, and you process what you see. It's bottom up.
Right.
Clark's predictive processing model flips that entirely. It argues that the brain is essentially an active prediction engine. It is constantly generating top-down hypotheses about what is about to happen in the next millisecond.
Wait, constantly?
Constantly. The only sensory information that actually gets processed all the way up the chain is the prediction error, which is the difference between what the brain expected and what actually happened. The brain is constantly trying to minimize that error.
Got it. So the brain isn't recording reality. It's hallucinating reality, only paying attention when the hallucination is wrong.
That's a very effective way to put it, yeah. Now add Daniel Schachter's work on constructive memory to that.
Yep.
The old view of memory is a filing cabinet or a video camera. You pull up a file from the past and you look at it. Schachter showed that memory doesn't work that way. Memory is constructive. We don't store perfect records. We store fragments. And every time we remember something, we rebuild it.
We rebuild it from scratch.
Essentially, yes. And crucially, we use those same fragments to simulate the future. Memory isn't about the past. It's a tool for predicting the future.
Okay, so now the brain is a prediction engine, and it uses fragmented memories to build those predictions.
Mm.
Where does Anil Seth and interoceptive inference fit into this?
Interoception refers to your brain's perception of your internal bodily states, your heart rate, your digestion, your breathing.
Right, the physical stuff.
Seth argues that emotions aren't just abstract feelings. They are your brain's top-down predictions about the state of your internal organs. If your brain predicts a sudden need for energy, it spikes your heart rate. The conscious experience of that physiological prediction error is what we label as anxiety or excitement. It's the affective layer.
Wow. So in this raw readingfragments.talk document, the researcher is trying to smash all these massive complex theories together into one functioning engine. They write, if prediction is always happening, and memory is constructive, and emotion affects prediction, then everything is feeding everything else.
Yeah, it becomes a massive tangle.
You can see on the page the exact moment the sheer complexity starts to overwhelm the initial simple idea.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you map a system where everything is simultaneously feeding into everything else?
This is a critical juncture in the development of the framework, and it brings up a really vital concept from the archive. How does the researcher handle that overwhelming complexity? They do it by identifying what we can call compression failures.
Compression failures.
In the archive's notes, specifically a post titled, "When Something is Close But Not Quite," Brizart writes about this explicitly.
Compression failure. That's a really interesting phrase.
To understand it, imagine you have a highly detailed three-dimensional physical object, like a sculpture, and you were trying to force it through a two-dimensional mail slot.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
You have to crush it, flatten it, and lose an enormous amount of structural data just to make it fit. The resulting crunch tells you that your current framework, the two-dimensional slot, is dimensionally inadequate for the reality of the object.
Okay, so when you try to force a new, complex, cognitive observation into an existing well-accepted academic label, and it doesn't quite fit without losing its nuance, that's a compression failure.
Exactly. When a concept feels almost correct, but leaves something out, that mismatch isn't just noise to be ignored. It's the first mechanical indication that something structurally distinct is present. The existing system cannot compress the new data without breaking.
That makes a lot of sense.
And the archive has another profound note on this called the irreversibility of unresolved structure. It argues that conceptual progress isn't an optional leisurely activity. Once an unresolved structure, a compression failure, begins forming in your mind, it generates internal pressure.
Like a cognitive itch you can't scratch.
Yes. You can't just ignore it and go back to the old model. That cognitive pressure persists until the structure is finally completed and resolves into something mathematically or logically stable.
So what does this all mean? We have all this messy raw material. We have the string board of unorganized thoughts. We have the collision of these massive theories of prediction and memory. We have these compression failures where the old labels don't work. And we have this inescapable internal pressure to resolve it. That's the raw.
Right.
Now let's look at the Polish. How does that messy thought about memory and emotion turn into hard math? Let's look at what that raw document eventually evolved into. It evolved into the temple feedback loop, or TFL.
The transition from the raw notes to the formalized TFL architecture is where you really see the value of a framework production system. The ambiguity is completely stripped away.
It really is night and day. Remember in the raw notes where the researcher was asking what drives what and does memory come in first? In the final TFL framework, those vague philosophical questions have crystallized into strict, formal variables operating over a very specific time frame, a 100 to 300 millisecond window.
And that time frame isn't arbitrary. The 100 to 300 millisecond window corresponds roughly to the speed of human conscious perception. It's the time it takes for a sensory input to travel up the neural pathways, get processed, and result in a conscious experience.
Right.
The TFL framework proposes that our entire reality is constructed in these tiny looping windows.
Let's walk through the actual variables of this loop, because this is where the theory becomes a system. If you're listening to this right now, maybe you're driving on your morning commute. Let's map your experience to the TFL variables. First, you have input, which is the real-time sensory information hitting your brain at this exact millisecond. In the car, that's the brake lights of the car in front of you turning red.
Correct. Then you have minfo. This represents the contextually relevant memory traces retrieved from the hippocampus.
Okay.
But it's not a full memory. It's the specific information relevant to that input. So your brain instantly pulls up the memory of traffic patterns on this specific highway or the memory of how hard you need to press your brake pedal.
Next is E. This is the affective or emotional state.
Yeah.
And the framework describes this functioning as a gained parameter. Wait, let's translate that. What does a gain parameter actually do mechanically?
Think of a gain parameter like the volume knob on an amplifier. ET doesn't necessarily change the content of the memory, but it changes the intensity or the weight of it.
Oh, I see.
If you are already stressed because you are late for work, your ET is high.
Yeah.
That high emotional gain acts like an amplifier, turning up the volume on the threat perception. The brake lights seem brighter, the need to react feels more urgent.
And if you're not stressed?
If you were relaxed on a Sunday drive, the gain is low, and the same sensory input doesn't trigger a massive physiological response.
That makes total sense. So you have the input, the relevant memory, and the emotional volume knob. All of that feeds into the next variable sim. This is the predictive simulation constructed from the input, the memory, and the emotion. This is Andy Clark's predictive brain in action. Your brain simulates what happens next. The car in front of you is stopping, so you will need to stop.
And finally, all of these interacting variables integrate into FT. The framework calls this the integrated internal representation of the present moment.
The felt now.
Yes, the felt now. It is the actual subjective experience you have of sitting in the car, seeing the lights, and feeling the urge to brake. The TFL framework argues that FT is not just a passive experience. It immediately becomes the prior state for the very next 100 millisecond loop.
It's a continuous rolling engine of reality generation.
Mm-hmm.
So stepping back from the math, what does this actually mean for you, the listener? It means the archive is letting you see the entire life cycle of an idea. You're seeing the exact moment a vague musing about how memory works crystallizes into a hard mathematical variable like minfo-t.
They are showing you the sausage getting made.
Exactly. They are proving the origin of the framework, not by pointing to a list of citations and saying, read what these other people wrote, but by showing you the cognitive fossil record of the idea itself.
And that fossil record serves a very specific structural purpose.
Yeah.
It proves that the final framework is a self-contained, internally consistent system built from the ground up to solve a specific set of compression failures. It isn't just a patchwork of borrowed authority from a bibliography.
Which is an incredible achievement in theoretical modeling. But a formal variable on a PDF is still just text on a page. It's nice theory. It looks impressive.
Uh-huh.
But here is where the Brizard Archive takes a massive, totally unprecedented step further. They don't just publish theories on PDFs. They publish code.
This is the moment the phrase framework production system stops being a metaphor and becomes literal.
Exactly. Let's look at the GitHub repository, Jason Brizard Research Archive. This repository is 100% Python. We are talking about executable framework systems.
Yep.
The usage model provided in the documentation explicitly states that these are public baseline reference implementations.
Yeah.
They are not just supplemental data files. They are meant to be cloned from the repository downloaded entirely to your local machine and executed locally.
The implications of this for cognitive science are enormous. Look at the history of the field. Theories of consciousness or theories of memory are almost always purely descriptive. They use language, English, French, whatever, to describe a cognitive mechanism.
Sure.
But human language is inherently ambiguous.
Hmm.
Words have multiple meanings. Sentences can be interpreted in different ways by different labs. Python is not ambiguous.
Right. Code is code.
Exactly. A Python script either compiles and runs, or it throws a syntax error and crashes. By forcing the theoretical framework into executable code, Brizard eliminates the ambiguity of language. The code is the theory.
Let's actually look under the hood. Let's look inside the O2 execution TFL folder in the repository.
Yeah.
They actually provide the pseudocode for a single TFL cycle. You have a central function called TFLSstep. It takes the current state, the sensory input, the input salience, and a set of parameters like DTMs, which sets the temporal window size, say 100 milliseconds, and it sets weights for the input, the memory, and the prior simulation.
Let's break down the logic flow within that TFLSstep function, because it translates the abstract math we just discussed into literal operations.
Yeah.
Step one is memory retrieval. In the code, it's minfit retrieve memory.
Okay.
It takes the current sensory input and searches the system's memory database for the most relevant prior context.
Step two is effective update. It calls update effect. This adjusts that emotional volume knob based on the salience of the input and the retrieved memory. Step three is simulation construction, where it builds the prediction. Step four is integration, where it calculates the new FT, the felt now. And then step five is diagnostics, where the code calculates the congruence of the simulation using something called cosine similarity.
Right.
Okay, wait, hold on. Cosine similarity.
Right.
What does high school trigonometry have to do with cognitive perception?
It's a great question, because this is where computational modeling gets really clever. In natural language processing and AI, you can't just feed raw words into a math equation. You have to convert concepts into numbers.
Make them quantifiable.
Right. You map words or concepts to coordinates on a multidimensional graph. These are called vectors. Cosine similarity is a mathematical way to measure the angle between two vectors on that graph to see how closely related they are.
Okay, give me an example.
Imagine a graph where one axis is furry and the other axis is danger. The vector for dog and the vector for wolf would be pointing in almost the exact same direction.
Because they're similar.
Exactly. The angle between them is very small, meaning their cosine similarity is very high. They are highly related concepts. But the vector for dog and the vector for toaster would be pointing in completely different directions, maybe a 90-degree angle apart.
Right. Not related at all.
So their cosine similarity is low. In the TFL code, the system uses cosine similarity to mathematically measure how closely its predictive simulation matched the actual incoming sensory reality. If the similarity is high, the prediction was good. If the similarity is low, you have a massive prediction error, and the system has to heavily update its models.
That is brilliant. It takes the abstract philosophical concept of prediction error and turns it into a quantifiable angle on a graph that a computer can calculate in milliseconds. It is a literal software engine for temporal perception.
And this brings us to the archives concept of plug-and-play frameworks. Right now, TFL is their first fully developed plug-and-play system. It is research-ready.
Ready to go right out of the box.
Yes. It is suitable for immediate experimental deployment. A research lab doesn't have to spend 6 months trying to translate a dense academic paper into code. They can literally pull this Python model, plug their lab's empirical data streams into the input variable, and run it to see if the engine produces outputs that match human behavior.
And it's not just TFL. The archive has other frameworks that are actively maturing toward this plug-and-play status. Let's just briefly define a few of these so we know what's in the pipeline. There's simulation synchronization theory, or SST. What cognitive problem does that solve?
SST tackles the problem of how multiple competing predictive simulations in the brain eventually synchronize into one coherent conscious experience. How do you go from a dozen different subconscious guesses about reality to one unified felt now?
Got it. Then there's residual identity echo theory, Riot.
Riot looks at the persistence of self. If your reality is being constructed in 100 millisecond chunks, why do you feel like the same person you were a second ago?
That's a profound question.
Right. Riot models the mathematical echo of identity that carries over from one TFL loop to the next.
And perceptual framing theory, PFT.
PFT models how our existing mental frameworks literally dictate what sensory data we are capable of perceiving. It's the math behind why two people can look at the exact same event and see completely different things based on their prior beliefs.
And finally, the temporal coherence resonance framework, TCRF.
TCRF models the larger systemic resonance. When TFL, SST, and PFT are all operating together smoothly, the system achieves a state of coherence. TCRF is the framework for measuring that overarching stability.
So you have an entire suite of executable cognitive models. This feels like a radical democratization of the tools of cognitive science. Anyone with an internet connection can download the underlying code of human perception. But there is a very specific strategic catch to all this, and that catch is the licensing model.
Yes, the Academic Research License Agreement, or the ARLA.
Let's talk about the ARLA.
The GitHub repository has very clear conditional use terms. Public access, which is unlicensed, allows you to clone the repo, run it locally on your laptop for evaluation, and study the code for structural understanding. It's fully open for educational inspection. But operational use is strictly not permitted without a license. Meaning, if you want to deploy the framework operationally, if you want to integrate it into your institutional research pipelines, feed it proprietary lab data, or develop derivative, modified implementations based on the code, your institution must hold a valid, formal ARLA license.
Okay, I have to push back hard on this. This feels incredibly contradictory. Science is fundamentally supposed to be open, right? It thrives on open collaboration and the free exchange of ideas. By putting this behind a licensing wall for operational use, isn't Brizard treating cognitive science like a B2B software startup?
It does sound like that.
It feels like they're selling enterprise SaaS licenses for theories of the human mind. If another lab can't modify the code without jumping through legal hoops, doesn't that stifle the very innovation that science relies on? I mean, look at Linux. Open source software runs the entire internet precisely because anyone can modify it.
That is the most common and valid critique of this approach. It does look like a B2B SaaS model, but we have to look at the specific pathology of academic science that Brizard is trying to cure.
Okay, what's the pathology?
In modern academia, the incentive structure is broken. If you publish a brilliant, completely open source theory, what happens? Other researchers will take it, modify one tiny variable, rename the framework entirely, and publish it as their own novel discovery to get citation credit and secure grant funding.
Ah, they fork the code to build their own resume.
Exactly. And what happens to the field? It creates a deeply fractured, noisy landscape of hundreds of slightly different, incompatible models. Nobody can compare their data because everyone is using a slightly modified version of the engine.
That's a mess.
It is a mess. By treating cognitive frameworks as proprietary, implementable software, Brizard mathematically prevents derivative fracturing. The CC BY-NC ND 4.0 license specifically prohibits derivative modifications.
But wait, if a lab finds a legitimate flaw in the code or a way to make it better, they are legally barred from fixing it. That seems counterproductive.
They aren't barred from proposing fixes. They are barred from publishing an unauthorized splinter version of the framework. It forces a standardization.
Oh, I see.
If a lab finds an improvement, they have to feed that back into the core Brizard project rather than creating a competing model. It forces labs to treat the models not as abstract philosophy to debate and tweak for easy journal publications, but as literal, standardized engines to license and run.
I see. So if Lab A at Stanford wants to use TFL and Lab B at MIT wants to use TFL, they use the exact same canonical TFL code base.
Precisely. It ensures that when two different labs run the framework and compare their findings, they are comparing apples to apples. They are running the exact same structural logic. The B2B licensing model isn't just about control or monetization. It's a structural mechanism to enforce rigorous standardization across a notoriously fractured field.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense when you frame it as preventing academic fracturing. It protects the integrity of the framework, but it raises the ultimate final question. Is this actually working?
A big question.
Right. You can build the most rigorous, executable, standardized framework in the world. You can write beautiful... Listen to the literature layer all you want. But if nobody is downloading it, if nobody is using it, you are just a rebel screaming into the void. Are institutional research labs actually playing along with this rebel approach?
That is the multi-million-dollar question. And to answer that, we have to look at the traction signals. Because BrizArt publishes through Zenodo, we actually have access to the raw data regarding engagement. And the data from the recent archive releases is highly revealing.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Let's look at the hard numbers. Let's start with the BrizArt format, or PBF. This isn't a specific cognitive theory. It's the standardized structural template they use to publish all these frameworks. It's essentially the meta layer, the instruction manual for the architecture. TBF currently has over 300 downloads and 360 views.
What's fascinating here is that in the context of highly niche, institutional-grade theoretical architecture, 300 direct downloads is a massive signal.
And the specific cognitive frameworks themselves are pulling in high volume, highly specific traction. The residual identity echo theory, RAT, has 98 downloads. The simulation synchronization theory, SST, has 95 downloads. Perceptual framing theory, PFT, and the temporal coherence resonance framework, TCRF, both have 70 downloads. And the flagship model, TFL itself, has 68 downloads.
We have to be careful how we interpret these numbers. In a traditional academic setting, success is measured entirely by citations. How many times was your paper referenced in the bibliographies of other papers?
Right, the borrowed authority we talked about.
Exactly. But remember our very first point today, BrizArt has explicitly rejected the literature layer. They don't want citations. In an evaluation after release paradigm, the metrics for success completely change.
Right, if you're building software, you don't measure success by how many people are writing blog posts talking about your software. Mm. You measure success by how many people are actually downloading the installer and running the program on their machines.
Exactly. Success is measured by downloads, by repository clones on GitHub, and eventually by institutional licensing inquiries. When a researcher clones a repository, it means they are copying the entire code base to their local environment.
It's a commitment.
It is an act of deep engagement, not just casual reading. The high download numbers for the standardized BrizArt format prove something absolutely crucial. Outside researchers aren't just casually browsing the theories out of curiosity. They are actively trying to understand the structural blueprint of the entire system.
They are downloading the format guide so they can understand how to interoperate with the BrizArt ecosystem.
Uh-huh.
They are literally learning the language of the system so they can plug into it.
Yes. And the spikes in downloads for the specific functional frameworks, like the 95 downloads for SST and the 68 for TFL, prove that the core strategy of releasing implementable system-first architecture is working. They are successfully bypassing the traditional literature layer.
They really are.
Institutional labs aren't waiting for these frameworks to slowly filter through a two-year peer review process and appear in a journal. They are quietly going directly to the archive, pulling the detailed PDFs and cloning the Python code.
The traction signals indicate that the evaluation after release model is finding a very real, very hungry audience. Labs are entirely willing to test the engines themselves without the proxy of citations, as long as the engines are robust enough to actually run.
Which they are.
And by providing executable Python reference implementations, BrizArt is offering a level of immediate operational utility that a standard 40-page academic paper simply cannot match. A peer-reviewed paper gives you a hypothesis to debate. The BrizArt archive gives you a functioning prediction engine to turn on.
It is a massive paradigm shift. It moves cognitive science from a descriptive discipline into an engineering discipline.
Okay, we have covered an enormous amount of ground today. We started by looking at a completely intentional, almost aggressive rejection of traditional academic references and the towering mountain of citations. We explored the deeply human, raw-to-polished pipeline, looking at how messy, uncertain thoughts and the pressure of compression failures eventually crystallize into rigorous mathematical variables like input and emotional gain parameters.
It's been wild.
And we ended up looking under the hood of a 100% Python GitHub repository that essentially turns the predictive mechanisms of the human mind into executable, licensable software code.
It really has. And for you listening, whether you're an academic, an engineer, or just someone fascinated by how systems work, yeah. I think this deep dive challenges how we all consume information and evaluate credibility in our daily lives. We are so deeply conditioned to trust things because of the citations.
We really are. We trust a news article because it quotes an expert. We trust an academic paper because it has a massive bibliography. We borrow authority constantly. But the BrizArt archive is asking a much harder, much more rigorous question. Do we believe something because 100 other people cited it? Or do we believe it because we downloaded the framework, ran the code, and saw the mechanics work with our own eyes? It forces us to move from passive trust in systemic authority to active mechanical verification of systems.
It does. And it raises a final vital question, and it's something I want to leave you to think about. If the BizARC Research Archive succeeds in its ultimate mission, if they truly make executable frameworks the new standardized baseline for cognitive science, we have to seriously consider the long-term implications. Will the future of psychology and neuroscience look less like a philosophical debate in a university lecture hall and more like standardized software engineering in a corporate server room? If intricacies of human cognition, perception, and memory are eventually fully reduced to functioning proprietary licensed Python code, who exactly gets to own the copyright to human consciousness?